You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Hello, everybody. Hello. Hello. There we go. My name is Liz Bailey, and I'm a first-year law student here at Harvard, and I am pleased and honored this evening to be able to welcome my uncle, Cliff Stoll, to speak with us this evening along with Professor Zittrin. And the topic will be something about computers and the interwebs and other creepy crawly stuff. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about their backgrounds real quick, and then we'll get started. So Cliff Stoll's background is in astronomy, but he's best known for catching a ring of computer hackers who were spying for the Soviet KGB using ARPANET. Raise your hand if you know what ARPANET is. Ah, this is a good room. Since then, Cliff has taught physics, written several books, and now makes Klein bottles, one-sided mathematical shapes that have zero volume. He remains a leading authority on computer security, having presented to the CIA, the NSA, and the U.S. Senate. He lives in Oakland, California, with three cats, two kids, one of whom is in the back, and one wife. Professor Zittrin is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, a co-founder of the Berkman Center, and served as Berkman's first executive director from 1997 to 2000. With degrees in law, public administration, and cognitive science and artificial intelligence, Zittrin's research includes digital property, privacy, and speech, and the role played by private middle people in internet architecture. He's also interested in identifying creative, useful, and unobtrusive ways to deploy technology in the classroom. I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Milbank, as well as the Harvard Law School Dean of Students Office and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And just so you know, we'll be recording and streaming this evening's presentation live on the Berkman Center's website. And so if you want to take another look at it later, you can go to cyber.law.harvard.edu. And without further ado, I present Cliff Stoll and Professor Zittrin.
Thanks. So I just met Cliff Stoll for the first time today, but it already feels like we are old friends. He's the kind of person that I suspect greets each day by leaping out of bed and sort of jumping around for the joy of just living, thinking, and exploring. If you look at his oeuvre in this space, say, apart from astronomy, not that kind of space, but the cyber law and cyber space, it is rife with a kind of playful, even mischievous, skepticism of the cyber utopianism that so many of us sometimes are wont to feel, and skepticism almost that any particular conventional wisdom is right. And I know he has a few thoughts he wants to open up with, on cyber warfare in particular, a subject that has been receiving increased scrutiny as the governments of the world, I think, are feeling more and more that they stand to have much to lose should they become the victim of an attack or their citizens or institutions become victims, and possibly see it also as an instrument of statecraft. So I thought we might have a chance to talk about that, at least from the précis that I think you drafted. We have something to hear about that. And we also have an amazing brain trust in the room, I can see already. So I know we can make it conversational very quickly. Yes, sir.
Meanwhile, I get to introduce you.
Oh.
I had this wonderful afternoon. I did a short spoutathon with some law students here. And then this guy says, oh, why don't you stop by my class? So I said, oh, cool, but you know, I'll sneak out. So I wander into this law school class with law students, and I think, oh,
you may know a law student.
And it was just high energy. I mean, 10,000 volts or more, just wonderful stuff. These students are just interrupting each other, yelling out answers, and it's about torts. He's there talking about, oh, suppose somebody sets a shotgun aimed at the door, and somebody else, you know, it's in an old abandoned building to keep somebody from breaking in, and well, we know this is unethical, but What kind of recovery do you get from this? You know, is it assault? Is it battery? Is it, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm there. I'm sitting in the back saying, wow, this is cool. And of course, I'm thinking to myself, well, it sort of has a parallel with this digital rights regime that was proposed and actually implemented by Sony, a rootkit, where if you misuse the digital rights, it'll erase your hard drive. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, yeah, I'm about to ask and say, no, I keep my mouth shut. I'm not a law student. And all I could say is, it just makes me want to just sit back. Nobody, I'm sure nobody does this. Maybe they do. Does anybody ever go to law school as a hobby, just for fun?
Well, I think we do tend to attract the brightest and the vaguest. So in some
sense... No, I mean with no intention of saying, oh, I want to get anything out of this other than entertainment.
Ah, it may be a little pricey for that, but sure, I think there might be a few. You would be welcome.
No kidding. You don't know how... It's way the phonometer was pegged. It was just. Having said that, unfortunately, I'm sad to say I recognize at least three people in the room who go back to Nashua and digital equipment. So, to those of you who are old deckies, I can say, yes, I've also paid my dues in VMS and PDP-11s and all of these things. So I too have survived into a world which sadly has no, where DEC is now considered historic rather than something that's in the future. What was I going to say?
You were going to say something about cyber warfare, cybersecurity.
A million years ago, when there were pterodactyls in Berkeley flying around, some hackers broke into my computer, and they're fooling around in it, and this was like 1985, 86, and I got offended because we were running this bunch of VMS systems and Unix systems, and I didn't take much truck with people hacking into it, so I tracked them down, caught them, and we prosecuted them in Germany. And this was way in the days of... There was something called East Germany and West Germany. And there was something called the Stasi and the KGB. Way out of the distant past. And to my sadness at the time, the internet was just beginning. In fact, I remember being ambivalent. Should I talk about the ARPANET or should I talk about the internet? Or should I really be just talking about BBN's work? And everybody said, ah, use the cutting edge term, the internet. So, okay. But, so eventually we caught some hackers breaking into our systems, and they were doing their best to steal military information. You could see the keywords they were searching on. You could see the locations they were going to. They kept mistaking Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories for Lawrence Livermore Labs, where they build nuclear bombs there and we do nuclear physics. And to the outsiders, those are the same thing.
It's possible Lawrence Berkeley Labs is actually an elaborate decoy.
we set it up as that. Yeah. And eventually we caught them. And along the way, various three-letter agencies, CIA, FBI, NSA, Air Force, OS, Office of Special Investigations, BBC, BB King, Doris Day, all these people, these various entities got a hold of me, and you found that, well, I found that they were semi-ept. Is that a reasonable word?
They were not inept, they were partially ept.
Yes. They'd want to hear everything that you're doing, but they'd never help, and they'd never do anything. Which, in doing physics, is a good thing because it lets you do the research rather than them doing it. By the time we actually figured out who it was, it required a great deal of international collaboration, far more than I ever imagined. I thought you'd just make a phone call, the phone company would put a trace on, they'd find out who it is, they'd tell you, and everything else would be real easy. It would be a tort, wouldn't it?
Right? I'd just Among other them, things.
Right? I just...
transfer the money from their account to yours, you're all done.
For the amount of time that I wasted. Yes. But then the question is, what have I lost? Have I lost the 11 months or 12 months it took to catch them, or have I just lost about 50 cents worth of computing time?
I think for the longest time, actually, statistics on the costs of hacking have been the time required to perform an exorcism on the machines, which does seem ancillary. It doesn't actually seem fundamental.
Yeah, it's not central. Yeah. You know, it's sort of, if somebody steals your car and it takes you 6 months to figure out where it's located and they haven't damaged the car, well, are you out anything? I'm sorry, this is... You gotta sit down in these torts classes. So forward to today. Of course, today, the old idea of a ring of hackers operating out of their cellar, breaking into American military computers or American computers, and then selling information to an Eastern Bloc spy service, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. Today it's a group of hackers operating out of probably not their basement, maybe a second floor apartment, breaking into computers and, if not selling it, at least passing it along to Asiatic organizations. The parallels to me are fairly evident that we're watching the internet being used to exploit other nations' infrastructures, and especially to track down people who are considered bad guys to various agencies. So
you mean like political dissidents and things?
Yeah, political dissidents.
Good guys to others, bad guys to the government.
Yes, the freedom fighters versus the terrorists.
Yes.
Along the way, about 20 years ago, 22 years ago, I wrote a short paper on how it would be possible to use computers and computer security problems to be exploited in a way that would be useful in a warfare situation. And I wrote this sort of just to satisfy myself and showed it to a friend who said, no, don't bother publishing. It's kind of a stupid idea. And so I passed along to somebody and eventually got a phone call from a guy at the CIA saying, oh, could you tell me more about this paper entitled blah, blah, blah. He'd heard of the paper and wanted a copy, so I sent it to him, and they invited me to this dome and gave a talk there, and it seemed obvious to me that this was the future of information gathering, that the idea of, oh, we got to infiltrate with spies may or may not be valid today, but certainly people are very interested in what keywords various governmental agencies are using around the world.
And what was the gist of the paper?
Oh, the gist of the paper was, I wrote two papers. One was how one would exploit computer connectivity to steal information from one's adversary and do so in a non-militaristic espionage manner. It was the kind of thing that, you know, James Bond would love. And the other side was what to do about it. You know, what are the problems facing the future of internet connectivity in the early 90s? And it saddens me today to look back and say, oh yeah, in a weird way it was prescient. My hopes then, as many of us had hopes then, and our hopes today, are that the internet will be this playground where good stuff comes, where people will be closer, more closely knit, and where we don't distrust the software that we download. We don't distrust the websites that we visit. We don't have to constantly worry about computer security, blah, blah, blah. Instead, there's a whole multi-billion dollar industry devoted to, of all things, computer security. It's such a letdown. It's instead of having a nifty, instead of saying, oh yeah, I can visit this website and there's cool stuff there, oh, I have to make sure that I have a blocking software to make to keep out things that might have malware built into them. Instead of saying, oh, you can download anything you want from this, I have to have virus checkers and garbage like this. To those of us, that I see many in the audience, we're let down over this idea that this once wonderful academic playground has become awash with bad feelings.
I sense you looking at the internet and saying that you're very disappointed.
The
amazing tool, kind of like almost the way television maybe had such promise and then became what it is. Yeah.
TV once there was going to be the cyber the televised classroom, the classroom of the future where Walt Disney cartoons would educate us all and we'd get the best teachers in the world delivered to us by way of television. Then it was, oh, VCR, videotape, would bring us the best teachers in every classroom. Then it was, oh yeah, we'll get it all by way of computers and CD-ROMs. Now it's, we'll get the best teachers in the classroom by way of the internet. And of course, you've already said it, I'm so deeply skeptical of these things, as an aside to everything that I'm saying, but I like to say things that are asides. My feeling is, if you want a good education, about the only way to get it is to find a pumped up, committed, dedicated teacher who will spend genuinely one-on-one time with you. What I want to see coming out of a classroom is a sense of commitment, inspiration, a feeling of working together to not so much to cover things, but rather to uncover things, to see what's underneath it all. I'm sorry, this is way off subject.
Well, I'm just wondering, as we respond to the realities that we now know have come, possibly inevitably with the mainstreaming of the internet as far as it's been, you know, Willie Sutton says he robs banks because that's where the money is. Now the internet is where the activity is to garner the circling sharks. Is the response one of, I don't know, where would you put it along a spectrum from cyber isolationism, just the whole thing is kind of tainted, let's back off, towards the ideal of having a distributed network that didn't require a playground monitor is itself what's now gone, and we just need governments or others to come in.
Curiously, what's happening, it seems evident, is for about five decades, the idea of information warfare and looking into other people's information systems was very much the monopoly of the National Security Agency. NSA had this to itself following World War II. There was nobody else who systematically collected signals intelligence from around the world. This monopoly was first challenged in the early 1990s and has been more and more challenged by, of all people, civil liberties groups in North America and increasingly by other governments around the world. Until today, it's odd to realize that other governments have set up their own equivalent institutions, like the National Security Agency, to listen in on signals, meaning the internet, belonging to other governments. And from there, it's not hard to ask the question, suppose a large power in the world sets up a group to spy on another organization by way of the internet, and we're essentially doing the same thing, what happens when these two Venn diagrams overlap? And some of the proposals that I listen to online and listen to on Thursday morning get-togethers in Berkeley suggest that we're seeing the very early parts of actual probing for warfare purposes, where no one wants to talk about what happened at Google in the past 6 months. Nobody wants to talk about tracking tracking internet traffic breaking into places and following them backwards into China. No one wants to talk about it, but increasingly things are pointing in this direction. In the same way that presumably people in other countries are saying, no one wants to talk about dot, 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 that, oh, some of these intrusions can be traced back to an American organization in Fort Meade. No one wants to talk about it because intelligence matters are best left out of public talk. But I ask, and I assume most of you are asking, what's in it? Infiltration and reading of information on an adversary's internet connection seems to me to be the kind of intrusion, the kind of spying that would very, very likely cause animosity, deep animosity, great upset between countries that are in many other ways working together.
Well, I mean, we certainly have the sense that we have countries right now, states, governments, trying to figure out whether what happens in cyberspace should stay in cyberspace, or whether some form of provocation initiated digitally could be grounds for a reaction, as they would say, kinetically.
Yeah.
And I think you see militaries trying to grasp that and coming up with the closest analogies they can. If somebody bombed your electricity generating infrastructure, you could surely bomb them back without having to limit yourself to their electricity generating infrastructure. If they sent bits in order to do it because they've compromised one of these so-called SCADA systems, would that entitle you to retaliation? My sense is the military answer would be yes. You wouldn't
And the evolved answer would be no. What are you, nuts? Somebody's breaking into your computer and you're going to go after them with a bomb? I'm sorry. You'd see this pulling at me in the wrong way.
Yeah.
I just have the sense of...
Well, as we hear the governments trying to sort this stuff out, and they do seem a little late to the party in recognizing the situation and wanting to deal with it, the things you hear them most commonly say are cyberspace is different because it has this leverage problem. Just a handful of people properly skilled can then compromise a sufficient number of resources out there to be, in effect, an army and then do something terrible.
E.g. botnets.
Correct. And another thing you'll hear them talk about commonly is what they call the attribution problem, which is that it's so hard to peel out the layers or go through all the Matryoshka dolls that are nested to figure out which precise 12-year-old is actually behind the attacks, or is it in fact, you know, a particular directorate of a state that is organizing it. And when you look at it that way, and I don't mean to assume that this is the right way to look at it, but when you look at it that way, it then raises the question in the big picture of, can we basically muddle through with the tools and practices we have right now, saying, what a shame that we all have to, like, you know, pay this tithe to Symantec just to have a passable chance at doing our business each day, or McAfee, or you name it. But basically, we muddle through. We fast forward 5-10 years, and it's basically the same information environment we have right now, with occasional stories and milestones of trouble, but we muddle through and hope we don't get struck by lightning next. Or is what we see some precipitous state change where, as you say, what you might be detecting are the beginning tendrils of information warfare at a scale not yet appreciated that might cause us, for instance, you can hear proposals among governments and even the corporate world saying the attribution problem is sticky enough that we need to solve that at a very fundamental level. Craig Mundy at Microsoft with Scott Charney at Microsoft have said we need internet driver's licenses. So before you can sign on, you have to identify yourself in some way to a traditional state agency, maybe the RMV, maybe not, that then issues you a card or a USB key and you plug it into your machine and now it's you responsible for your bits and now we don't have the Matryoshka doll problem. Do you see that kind of state change or is it muddling through?
I'll be surprised if there's ever any organization that says, hey, we're in charge and you're responsible to us. There's too many national groups which dislike one another to ever combine. I mean, look at the problems just in getting the .su internet top-level domain to go away. The Soviet Union top-level internet domain still exists, even though the Soviet Union doesn't exist. Just dealing with top-level domains, which ought to be a trivial thing to do, IETF can't handle it. Nobody can. I can't deal with it. To get everyone to say, oh, here's my name and address. The following bitstream belongs to me.
So that seems very fair.
It's a dream world that I used to live in.
Yes.
And I thought, no kidding. There was once this time. There was this idyllic time. You're smiling. There was this idyllic time when I probably knew close to 1% or 2% of the people who used the ARPANET. Where you would send a message from Berkeley to Cambridge just to see if the damn backbone was up. You know, you'd get a ping.
That time may come back.
Yeah, right. But you'd get a message from SRI, and you knew who sent it, just from the initials.
But this may be then a tale of the classic nostalgia.
Oh, of course.
That says, you know, I remember when I knew 1/10 of the editors on Wikipedia,
right.
And 1/10 of the articles were about Star Trek. And now,
of course,
you ask for a random page, you don't know what you're going to get.
Of course, it's also, oh yeah, the small village suddenly
going to
the world.
And then there's the kind of there goes the neighborhood feel with all of the ambivalence that phrase evokes.
I'm not only saying, oh, it'd be nice to be back like that, nor am I even, rather, my concern is I'm hearing more and more studies put together within a 50-mile radius of Washington, which I assume includes Fort Meade and Quantico. The FBI, the CIA, and especially the NSA are very interested in what's happening in information theft, information security. I'm concerned that the internet that we're using today may, and the security problems involved in it, may become an excuse for doing mean things and spreading paranoia.
Right. So what you say is there's always the risk of what we would call an iatrogenic reaction.
Yes.
Where the cure is worse than the disease. And there's like a Patriot Act for cyberspace waiting on the shelf for just the right kind of...
When some clown figures out how to shut down the backbone widely.
Yes.
And does so. And I remember April 13th when for 5 days nobody could get any work done in my office because everything was shut down. Yeah. And then they say, we can't let this happen again. Therefore, the czar of cybersecurity.
Yes. But then this cries out for... This cries out then for, when I was thinking about the spectrum, right?
Yeah.
That one spectrum is just, don't put anything on the internet that you couldn't stand to lose. Which, when you look at the way cloud computing is going, yes, more and more, if you lost connectivity for a week, your life would be in greater disarray than even a few years ago. If your calendar's on GCal and your mail's in Gmail or all the equivalents, Google Docs. So one thing is just to say, don't put anything on it that you couldn't stand to lose. Which in a way is Wikipedia's answer, I suppose, to vandalism, which is don't put anything in an article that you couldn't stand to have vandalized and then maybe we'll revert it later, but we're not going to use it as an opportunity for panic. On the other end of the spectrum is to say, this is lunatic that we have a network that was built for such a different purpose, and that so much had as its invisible gluons, people who knew each other and could pick up the phone if there was a problem. Now that we're in this new zone with new threat, we may need a quantum change. And that gets back to the question of internet driver's licenses and other things.
The same thing was once upon a time true of roads. I mean, the idea of roads in North America started out as dirt pathways.
Yes.
And they evolved into the interstates.
And the nature of the traffic has changed enormously. The nature of the rules has changed. But no one is saying, oh, we need to rethink.
Well, fair enough, although the roads may not suffer from the same leverage problem and attribution problem that the problems in cyberspace might. But I hear from you a worry of overreaction and therefore a desire.
Does it work? Yeah, it's not coming up.
Oops.
Oh, why don't I just change this around?
What? Thank you.
Therefore, a desire to find some middle path because it's more useful than mine.
Well, yours can be used as a noose.
Yes, that.
I'm sorry.
That is tremendously useful. Kind of the gift that keeps on giving.
Right, yeah. Keeps on taking.
Yes. This is from a guy who has knitted a Mobius scarf. Can also be used as a noose, but not a clean one. So when I had asked if you thought there might be a drastic state change, one answer is, well, it's awfully hard to get everybody to agree on what the change would be and then to implement it. On the other hand, what we see are either, okay, there could be fiat. If people got nervous enough, you could have something resembling a Patriot Act for cyberspace, whatever you'd fill it with. And you have the power of standards, this kind of centripetal force that keeps pushing things inward.
The standards, curiously. Internet standards are, there's lots of them. The standards group it's surprisingly hard to get any changes to existing standards. For those.
Precisely because they're so successful.
Yes, they're so successful, they're embedded into hundreds of millions of computers around the world. Just changing from the version 4 to version 6 of the Internet Protocol, which is soon going to be required because we're running out of address space. Just making that change has proven to be more than a decade of work, and it's astonishingly hard to get done.
Yes.
And that's not at an individual's level. It's just
right.
ISPs around the world need to agree.
And I suppose what you see when you can't change things fundamentally, then you see kludges at the application layer, whether it's on numbering,
and
like
the kludges.
Yes.
To get people to say, oh, I need my personal identity connected to my bitstream. At first I start thinking, oh, we'll have really cool biometric identifiers where you put your finger in, your fingerprint will be read, or drop my DNA in and it'll say, oh, this belongs to so-and-so's DNA. I realize there's no way I can get that out to hundreds of millions
of users.
Then
you look,
users.
This gets back to this centripetal force that can come from cascading standards. I think we're kind of at a pivot point
Am I not? I'm a throwback saying it's because it's hard to do, it's not going to happen. You're right.
Well, and I think of something like Facebook Connect. Within the past 3 days, who has logged into a site that is not Facebook using Facebook credentials? By clicking on the Facebook Connect button.
Yeah.
Wow, not that many. I would have expected many more hands to go up. The people who raise their hands are feeling ashamed. Like, what's wrong with me? But I could see from one place to which you credential, starting to want to use those in multiple places instead of having to remember the same, you know, let me in password that you use for the sites you don't care about. And ultimately then, that one corporate anchor could go bonus biometric, and then it cascades out to the many other sites. And in that sense, it wouldn't be a driver's license as a requirement, but rather as a site-by-site option. If you want to shop at Amazon and you want to buy something over $500, you're going to need the
We want to know who you are beyond your credit card number.
Right.
Sure, sure. And eventually, you want to fly on an airline. Why, of course, you need to be identified by what... It soon walks into Big Brotherism, and it soon. I'm sorry, I still can't see how this would, without the largest sea change, I don't see how this would accomplish the problem of authenticating who is it that's spreading this particular worm, this particular virus, or is breaking into my website. Who is it that's responsible for screwing around with the electric grid or attempting to do so? Because those people are going to be at least smart enough to cover those particular identification traffic.
Yep, that could be.
It filters out most 13-year-olds.
But then is the picture you're painting one of checkmate? I mean, what path forward do you see?
Oh, I see muddling, as it always has been online. Everything is always muddled. Every proposal to get rid of spam has always, you know, oh, what a cool idea, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Every proposal to make for a more secure system that I'm using sort of works, and I pay for it by having to update it.
And do you think that is an epistemic truth?
What does epistemic mean?
I mean, is it innately true about any form of digital progress, or is it something that has to do with the Internet's peculiarities compared to other information technologies like the telephone system or television?
I don't get viruses often from library books.
Yes. Well, even for watching TV. It's not like, oh, you tuned in Fox 25. I'm sorry, your television set is irreparable now.
There are cool things that you can do.
Yeah.
There's cool data streams that you can send over digital TV.
Screw with the closed captioning or something.
It's a different kind of coolness. I don't think we're going to see... I think implicit in the Internet is a lack of... I don't think the deep down fundamentals, the IP, the TCP, the deepest part of the Internet is going to evolve much in the future because there's such a huge base out there. Things layered on the very top. Oh, yeah,
yes.
I want better identification, authentication of tweets. Yeah, that's much more likely to happen.
Yes.
But that's a very high level thing
and
doesn't address the weaknesses that I suspect are being exploited and being attempted to be exploited by people who are professionally interested in screwing around with other nations' infrastructures.
For which then it is also helpful to keep in mind a rough taxonomy of the kinds of bad things that can happen over the Internet thanks to someone else's maliciousness. We've already raised the prospect of surveillance of various flavors. The anchor point of the Google controversy recently appears to be highly sophisticated, targeted, wow, who knew somebody would put this much effort into it, compromise of a handful of key machines, of employees of Google, from the way it's told, that in turn compromised a bunch of subscribers because those employees had privileged access. So there's the surveillance piece, there's the denial of service piece, where you can generate enough robots from existing computers and PCs themselves compromised to bring down a site, which you're right, then that's happening at the level of IP, and Facebook Connect doesn't help you there. And then there are things like phishing and other fraud that may be more application layer. So
almost as if you're seeing the breaking into computers and stealing information in general isn't that hard. What's surprisingly difficult is to target one thing and say, I want this one piece of information. It's surprisingly easy to say, oh, I want general information. Oh, hey, that's easy. But I want this person's email. That's phenomenally difficult and requires lots of work, oftentimes involving what's crudely called social engineering. In other words, trying to convince somebody to give you their passwords or their credentials by simply talking to them or talking to their colleagues.
Yes.
The going into a server machine to go after one's Gmail is far, far more difficult and challenging. Yeah. And it's that part that's so scary about the most recent Google intrusions.
And for which one possible thought is another reaction you could see to this, more market-driven, more kind of natural than a top-down intervention, is to actually change the character of the machines hooked up to the Internet. So many of them are general purpose machines that can be reprogrammed in a heartbeat to do whatever you want. Oh, I see, it takes recipes now. Oh, it's Skype. Oh, it's a game, who knew? You have new architectures emerging, right? Those who know me know what I'm about to say. call it the iPhone or the iPad or you name it, where what applications can actually run on the machine are driven by one vendor, which at a sea change level might affect the kind of security you can expect. Because if you're not able to run any old code just because you were lured into it, I want to see the hamster dance, you may well be protected. Now, it does create a kind of Fort Knox-like vulnerability.
At the same time, monocultures encourage...
That's the Fort Knox-like vulnerability. Yes. I was just saying that if you compromise one employee at Apple, all right, imagine, right, there must be a bunkerized server guarded by Marines somewhere from Microsoft that does critical updates automatically and pushes them out to the to an order of magnitude how many? Order of magnitude, probably 1 billion Windows machines out in the world. And if you were managed to compromise that and sent an emergency update out that was like, please delete your hard drive, that would be noticeable. So you're right, there's the monoculture problem. But supposing you've managed to guard the bunker, then you might claim for a machine whose borders are not as malleable by the consumer, him or herself, this could be a sea change in the level of security. The iPhone hacks I've seen have been against jailbroken iPhones, not against iPhones proper. Of course, if you're a government wanting to listen in, it means you could serve a warrant in Cupertino, California, and pick your iPhone. And because it's such a managed environment from afar, it's the equivalent of a cloud computing configuration, even though it's in your hand running the code, that may well offer new opportunities for surveillance. I wonder if we shouldn't open it up to comments and
questions, comments,
and
insults.
And then I might have a proposal to suggest to you towards the end. But are there thoughts? And do we need to get a microphone to people?
Here, or? Have a microphone.
My name's Marlena Erdos. I work in security. I'm co-author of the Java Security Reference Model. So I'm really interested in the law side and what you brought up to begin with, which had to do with reactions, recovery, just even with Google and now diplomacy in the U.S. Any thoughts about how governments will respond? You also brought up a power grid, and would there be a kinetic response? And you were saying no, but it's something that could really take down a country for a while. What would be, in your eyes, both of you, reasonable responses? So I guess that's two questions there. But could you talk about the legal part?
At least on the second piece of it, I might part ways with Cliff. We'd have to talk more about it to figure it out. But I'm not sure I would observe a line between bits and atoms just because. You know, if an agent of a state took out our electricity and then was like, but we only did it by hacking, so I'm afraid your response options are limited, I would not feel persuaded by that. You do get to the attribution problem again. What if it's just a nationalistic citizen of that government, you know, helping the cause without actually being motivated? It seems awfully weird that you would, like, bomb the country in it. It's like you might demand that person, kind of hollow, like...
That's basically a plausible deniability argument.
Which is why I think you see so many government people racing towards an attribution model, both so they can exact justice or know when to do a disproportionate response state to state rather than law enforcement.
But that's not going to be, it sounds like, unless what Cliff, sorry,
it's especially with the whole idea of people, everybody in the world getting, even within a country, the U.S. getting an identity, to me seems unlikely. There's a lot of, you know, you'd have to have a massive help desk for, access problems. But so, how do you see that happening with, like internationally, like China and the U.S.? Because presumably we're spying on them, they're spying on us. And is there any international law, any sort of reason that somebody would try recourse through a legal international law channel rather than other means?
Yeah, Jack Goldsmith has been writing a lot about this. I think the short answer is it is a long and tortured path to feel like international law helps you out. At the level where you are at state-to-state conflict, you either work it out through diplomacy or you start shooting at each other. I feel like that's kind of the major options.
Or you cork up holes.
You mean you just try to defend against further attack
or
something. Yeah. If you think that it might be nationalistic citizens getting out of hand or gangs or something like that, or at one point Macedonia found its bits blocked by intermediate backbone ISPs around the world because it had become such a haven for hacking and crime. And like the few Macedonians left were like, please help, send bits. like an airlift of bits to Macedonia, see what they've been missing. The daily drudge, yeah. And you could see a role then maybe when you look at like cybercrime treaties and such. That's what they're talking about, how to make it so that there's not a ready digital haven for private bad guys. But once it's state to state, I feel like you are in the realm of, you know.
30 years ago, I lived in Nanjing, China for a year. And it was a tough time because the astronomers were just coming out of the fields from the Great Cultural Revolution. And I've stayed in touch with several of them. And one of them, I've stayed in loose touch with one of his kids, who tells me about how there's a movement amongst college kids in China, loosely knit, that it is our duty to cause problems for American computers as a sense of our patriotic yearning for helping our country. Needless to say, this is misguided, sad, and you find the same kind of silliness or stupidity happening here. And yet I don't see how to... A treaty clearly could deal with this and say, hey, we will slap your wrists if you do this. But it's very difficult to say, oh, this is coming out of some misguided 18-year-olds' minds rather than it's state-sponsored. It's very difficult to.
I mean, one thought that might be down the middle there is if the heart and mind of that 18-year-old is up for grabs, how to offer something more appealing than the particular subscription that person just chose. I feel like in a way that is, for the moment, just for the moment, Wikipedia's secret sauce. It deals with vandalism not by trying to figure out who is affecting an unauthorized access to a Wikipedia page beyond the scope of permission, since it's vandalism, and then throwing the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act or its counterparts at them, but rather recruiting enough people to reply to them in the most annoyingly patient way. You know, it's like you get a message next time you log in that's like, thank you for your experimentation on Wikipedia. You might want to try the sandbox next time for that rather than a live article. Have a nice day. And you're like, damn it, I was trying to annoy you. And 3 times later, they're like, you know, you may be having some issues. We're thinking about possibly cutting off your IP address. Love to hear from you. And by that time, if you're like from 4chan, you're just like, I got other people to annoy. Like, this is just, these Wikipedians are crazy. Or you find yourself recruited. And then you're like, wow, there's a counter-vandalism unit at Wikipedia that stands around all day and runs scripts and otherwise takes actions to clean up pages. And as long as you've got more people more intrigued by doing that than you have the number of people trying to bring it down, it so far stays afloat. So one question would be how to take that spirit and see if you could implement it at this lower level when you talk about gangs
in
of
Germany,
people and such.
In Germany, there's the Chaos Computer Club, which originally was genuinely dedicated to causing as much trouble for existing computer networks as possible.
Now they have an annual meeting at like the Sheraton Berlin.
No, it's genuinely become a very much like, oh, a similar thing in North America was DEF CON, which started out, oh, the from the old 2600 crew saying, hey, let's cause as much trouble because our job is to deal with Ma Bell, who is such a bunch of jerks. They're charging extra when you get touch tone. You know, the 1960s and 70s.
And now they have Birds of a Feather sessions.
No, yeah, now they have, like, wow. Now the, you know, this 2600 phone hackers, phone freaks, turned into a hacker movement, which genuinely caused a lot of worry.
So this is the killer bees theory of the internet, right? Do you remember the their killer bees are coming. They're coming from Mexico. I mean, there was this whole kind of weird ethnocentric element to it. And then, like, years later, it's like, you know, they chilled out. In fact, there are too few of them now. Yes?
I'd like you to speculate on what may be urban mythology at the moment. Over the weekend, in a dinner conversation, one of the guests raised as a question as to whether or not the failure of Toyota's braking and acceleration systems could be a cyber attack of corporate espionage, and whether the implications of this, if true, would Toyota ever admit it, and whether the implications for mass transportation generally.
The design, the question is, did Toyota's acceleration problem possibly be a computer design, be a computer intrusion problem? I had a fun time of talking with a Toyota repair person in Berkeley, who pointed out that the problem is where little fingers at the back of the pedal were interacting with fingers. It was very much an interarticulation like this. Mechanical problem.
But they're saying they could fix it with a firmware update. And what you can fix with a firmware update, right. You could...
There's two problems. The Prius one is a design problem between switching between braking mode and regeneration mode. And when you go over bumps, there's a problem. Now, that is a software problem, and I
conceivably
don't know anything
maybe,
about whether it's a hack or not, but it could be. But the other one's a mechanical problem in the pedal.
Yeah.
So
and it was a mechanical design problem.
But without that specific anecdote having to be one way or the other, the particular incident, the question still arises as we try to design more hackable and updatable physical objects. We basically take the cloud model for IT and start to port it to physical devices. Do we open ourselves up to the kinds of vulnerabilities that seem so prevalent in the IT world? And it's funny, because in my general orientation, I'm so excited about hackability of the sort of you can change and tinker with your own stuff. But when it becomes, start tinkering with your car, get rid of that annoying beep, beep, beep sound it makes when it backs up, my torts professor side starts coming through and be like, wait a minute.
There's truly cool things that there's a great deal of firmware and software in cars today. Unfortunately, it's amazingly undocumented, and it's very difficult to figure out what it is without poking around and playing with it, which in turn is much fun, but is likely to cause problems in doing it.
But there might be a real ambivalence about having a generative physical infrastructure of the sort that starts to treat atoms like they're bits and makes them reprogrammable. As much as I'm totally into a generative IT infrastructure, I do worry about something that would reprogram all our refrigerators to be, extremely cold. What's the worst you could do with, maybe that's a bad example.
No, turn them off.
Turn them off.
You say, hey, we're going to have programmable refrigerators so that during low power brownouts, we'll shut off refrigerators for 20 minutes. You just say, hey, shut it off for 5 hours and people start losing food. A perfectly reasonable thing to program into your refrigerator, saying, oh, we're low on power in Northern California, let's power down refrigerators for 20 minutes. Oh, let's sneak in and change that from 20 minutes to
enough. I think
time
there are actually now some coffee machines out there that are internet programmable, and they turn out to be hackable, and so you can actually launch an attack on some poor firm's coffee machine, and it's like spewing coffee into nowhere, and they blame accounts. So, it's worrisome. I have the same worry about treating human labor configurations as if they are IT cloud computing. Mechanical Turk or internet games that turn out to be like Ender's Game, where you're playing a game and having fun, but you actually are deploying troops or something less. Yes. And the fact that those are so readily deployable by anybody that can write a check or, set it up, is worrisome to me in a way, again, that generative technology, IT, is not. And I'm struggling through my own ambivalences about that. Sorry, Cliff.
In the back of my mind through all this, I'm just still charged up over this class that I sat in. It teases me off that I can't just sit in and as a hobby, just sit in on torts classes from now on. But while I was working at Lawrence Berkeley Labs a billion years ago, one of the computers that a hacker that I was following broke into was called a PETVAX, P-E-T-V-A-X. The VAX part was meant that it came from this area of the world. The PET part stood for positron electron tomography. This was one of the very first quasi-diagnostic use of positrons in brain research. And the guy broke in, and we immediately shut him off and reprogrammed the machine so that he couldn't get in anymore. That was like a 5-minute effort. And we were watching, detected it, and immediately shut the door. But it reminds me that when fooling around with other people's systems and computers, very seldom do you or I or the people doing the fooling around, very seldom do they know what the sequelae, what the results will be of their screwing around. You know, something says PETVAX. Oh, it's a little pet thing. You don't realize, oh, it's a medical machine controlling radiation going into a human being. In the same way, I start thinking about this, this delicious class where people would say, well, to what extent is a hacker breaking in truly not knowing that he's screwing around with a medical machine? To what extent is he responsible for what happens to a patient stretched out underneath this large radiation treatment?
And for those who have taken torts, what case would you offer up? Don't make me cold call. A little Vosburgh versus Putney action, don't you think? Yes, Vosburgh versus Putney. For which, once you've done the wrong, the law might say you're responsible even for unforeseeable consequences of that wrong.
Oh, really? How unforeseeable? No.
It is. It's a meta case.
Really?
Well, with appropriate qualifications that take 6 to 8 months to fully digest, but yes. Yeah. Now, I have a proposal I wanted to float quickly and get reactions from people that are still trying to figure out a way out of this checkmate situation we've been describing. And that is, what if we were to develop, at the protocol layer, maybe HTTP rather than IP, some technologies that facilitate mutual aid among sites that could be subject to any form of disruption of the flow of bits between them and the people who want to get
there.
How
would I trust that other site?
So, what you might imagine, for example, would be embedding into, there are only basically two major web servers in the world. There's Apache and there's Microsoft. So, nice way of making a change.
That means there's only one good one.
We won't say which. So, imagine making it so that when you, as a web server now, render a page of links as a part of a web page, it's got links in it, right? That's part of the fun of the web. Normally, you just render the links, and then people click on it. And when they click, their own browser tries to go off to where the link is. End of story. If they can't get there, they can't get there. We're all done. Suppose you made it so that as you render the page of links, you go off and grab yourself the stuff to which the links point with the digitally granted permission of the target sites. They set up their configuration to say they welcome this form of mutual aid. Then when somebody clicks on a link and can't get there, they come back to you and say, would you mind? I just clicked on your link, but I couldn't get there. Can you show me what you just had that you thought was worth linking to? And the server says, sure, here it is. And vice versa. If that site links into you, they might cache the most important stuff, archive the most important stuff on your page. With that tweak to a web server, you could suddenly see easily an opt-in network where sites that all link to a site could start to be able to support it should they become the hole in the donut. Everything circling the hole in the donut then has what was in the middle. And if any given site hands you a dishonest answer as to what they saw, you might ask three others and start to compare notes. There's a project for which this is being done for important archival copies of stuff at libraries called LOCKS here at Harvard. L-O-C-K-S-S, lots of copies keep stuff safe, is what that backronym stands for.
It's related, there's a, those of you into cryptography will recognize that this is related to web of trust distribution of
keys. Yes.
Where a major problem in passing.
Yes.
Passing, when you have secure communication from over here to over here, it's necessary to have some trusted way to get a secret key from here to here. And there's sort of two ways to do it, one of which is to have
Fort Knox,
a centralized server called VeriSign or fill in the blank that will pass it over and everybody trusts that guy and only that guy. And the other is to have a web of trust where, Phil Zimmerman's pretty good privacy uses a web of trust where...
Which is kind of how Facebook friending works.
Yes,
somebody friends you and you see all the friends you have in common and surely they're worth friending. The fellow in the back had an intervention that seemed rather urgent.
When you started the question of, if your website's out, you go to mine, if mine's out, go to Cliff's. But the question was, suppose I'm not trying to deny service, but to subvert it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, so you'd have a locks model. And in fact, there are many implementations. Once you get going on this zone, you could actually see a whole network where as people are reporting they can't get somewhere, that gets aggregated, and participating websites who are part of this mutual aid pact, if I go down, you'll mirror my stuff. If you go down, I'll devote some measure of bandwidth and processor to mirroring yours, actually makes it that the more reports of blockage happen, the more places you can find the stuff that was blocked.
Barring open source and other verification, how are we to know that your scheme isn't simply the bad guys trying to get one giant step?
Oh, because it would be from like Harvard, and you can trust Harvard. That was easy.
A little bit of money to
yeah,
fund it.
What could possibly go wrong? Up front? Yeah.
So first, we kind of already have a globally effective version of locks, maybe not fully functional. It's called the Google Cache, right? Google has...
A little bit of a Fort Knox issue there, but yes, Google Cache is often used as a poor person's circumvention tool.
Yeah.
But then a bad government just blocks the cache and game over.
Yeah. And the second thing is a question kind of following on Nolan's point about the Toyota, in that even if we were to, solve the attribution problem from a consumer perspective, that attribution problem is never going to go away in the sense that what's to stop a state-owned industry who has a flaw in their product to claim it's a flaw when it's actually malicious versus not? Determining intent is never going to be solved technologically, right? So as long as we have these international corporations going back and forth, and sometimes they're agents of a state, then I can't imagine that attribution problem ever being solved.
Doesn't intent...
So get, what do we do about it?
If it's an agent of a state... The Nowhereville secret agency is breaking into our Department of Treasury. Isn't intent immediately transparent and obvious?
But what if it's same problem happened to General Motors and it only affected Buicks that were distributed in
China? I think you're right. You'd have to do some regular gumshoe work now. I mean, it would be like any time you're trying to figure out who was behind something mysterious. And it means you need a whistleblower, or you need to have penetrated the organization, or you threaten the right people with subpoenas or worse, and you just try to get to the bottom of it. But you're right that, we haven't solved the Kennedy assassination yet. Like, there's all sorts of things for which the attribution problem exists. When you hear the government people talk about it, they somehow think it's more persistent, deeper, structurally worse in cyberspace. So it would maybe be progress just to get it to the point where it is with almost any run-of-the-mill conflict, where sometimes it's cloudy who's behind it. Just logistically, I was thinking we'd go for another 10 minutes. We just end at 7:20, and then people who can stick around to talk. There's many more hands up, so we should just get the mic flowing. Just wherever, that's fine.
I was just curious about, in terms of state actors, to what extent is deterrence possible? And is that a model that's worth thinking about or pursuing? And to what extent state actors are really important in this?
Right now, I don't think state actors are very important. Let's see if I use the right verbs here. I strongly suspect that our main state actor is the National Security Agency, and its main focus today, I strongly suspect, involves what's largely perceived as terrorism, and that's probably centered on Middle Eastern derivatives in the information world. I suspect that the NSA and its friends are not very active in going after large groups, the largest governments such as China, and even so much as groups from the former Soviet Union any longer.
And may I actually just use this opportunity to cold call Joseph Nye and see if, I know he's been thinking a lot about this, if you have some thoughts on that question about state actors and action.
I was surprised by your focusing on NSA and not on China. Very hard to know in China what is state and non-state. Is Huawei state or non-state? What about Huawei's connections with PLA? What about systematic theft of intellectual property of American companies? Systematic, meaning you take the whole intellectual property and replicate it for your own purposes. That seems to be state action of a very high order of importance.
It's, what if I even say it? It's almost culturally set into the system. It's in some ways one might say the history of intellectual property that we enjoy here is essentially non-existent within China.
But it's a little bit more than that. If we took a man from Mars or person from Mars perspective and we said, what is going on between a set of servers in country A and country B? We're doing a lot to China. They're doing a lot to us. Some of it's by patriotic hackers. Some of it's by government. To the extent, though, that you see it done by government, it has a different characteristic. For the Chinese, it's a systematic effort to enhance Chinese power, the power of the Chinese government.
Centralized government.
Centralized government. Whereas for the U.S., it's much more exploiting, finding out, and so forth when it's done by the government.
Indeed, the NSA is explicitly required to not spy on any nationals. Anyone in the United States, the NSA is hands off. Beyond that, they are extremely reticent to do anything against, or that could be interpreted as against close allies. And within China, almost the opposite is true. The state organizations are set up so as to look at and examine what's happening within the state and certainly what so-called enemies of the state or dissidents are doing elsewhere. No question whatsoever. I happen to be more familiar with what's happening here, so I'm not speaking so much to that.
I just wanted to make the point when you said we'd focus just on NSA, that there are other governments, particularly China, which are doing things related partly to enhance stealing intellectual property for fun and profit, but also for magnifying Chinese power.
Oh yeah, the paranoid organization worries most about those who are closest to it, and it brightens this poor astronomer's heart to realize that our government, by and large, is not paranoid. That the history of the United States is such that the government feels that, oh yeah, dissonance within the country is a good thing and an acceptable thing. That's not shared by many other governments. Right.
Fellow way in the back is about to fall off the...
United States does kind of create an open atmosphere, and you take, like you said, 4chan, and it's, you know, causing chaos within our own system, but, you know, whether it's just them getting their lulls or, like, really having an intention of destruction behind it, it's a different story where you take, you know, within Russia or China and the Russian business network and Storm botnet, how much is that really interplaying with the state organizations as well as, you know, an organizational crime organization, I mean, a systematic organizational crime system. So it gets very touchy there. The other question I feel and I'm concerned about mostly is, as we develop artificial intelligence, how much of this then becomes bots operating on their own intention instead of human programmed intention? And, I mean, that's where it gets scary, because they're operating by themselves, and you've seen, yes. I don't know if you guys read the case.
Most botnets are mighty primitive in their...
Right now they are.
Right now they are, sure. In 15 years, who's to say?
Isn't it a case that we actually, I mean, no army in the world, I don't think, can go toe-to-toe with the United States in land, sea, air, or space? Isn't it a future that we could see, where last year they decided that cyberspace was an equal domain to those, that in the future of warfare could actually just happen on that domain?
On the Skynet issue, where do you fall?
I was taught millions of years ago, when I was an undergrad during the Jurassic Age, I was taught, hey, World War I was a war of biology, World War II was a war of physics, World War III will be a war of mathematics or information. And yeah, I hear you loud and clear. On the other hand, I'm also... I have a feeling that I'd survive if all my internet were cut off from me, that I'd still be able to fix the leaky toilet in my bathroom. But maybe I couldn't. I haven't tried it. The solar things on my roof will still.
I hear Cliff saying, "So long, suckers." Finally.
No, I hear you. I offer no panacea.
A couple more, wherever you can park it.
Hi, my name is Patricia, and I'm a journalist for the Chinese media in Canada. And I'd like to ask a question that's related to both the hacking wars and academia. And due to the, well, I hate to say escalating, like, cyber mistrust between the U.S. and China in the recent days, will research activities of grad students from the PRC in subject areas that are related, seen as related to defense, be restricted or somehow obviously or subtly monitored? And also, will grad students from the PRC trying to apply to such subjects be kind of disadvantaged in their admissions process?
Because graduate students in Li Si, in physics, in Tianwen, they want 他们 students coming here to study physics, astronomy, from any place in the world, they're smart, they're intelligent, they'll be working hard, and these are sciences that, for which the research you're doing is beneficial to everyone. No, I don't think they will be looked upon or spied upon. It just doesn't feel, the academic world in the United States is so open, is so, tell me I'm wrong, but it's such an open, encouraging thing. If any place, it's the one place where there's the minimum amount of big brotherism. That may be changing. This may be a dream world that I have in my mind.
You could ask the question both within a university environment for somebody already there and at the border. You know, are they going to be able to get their student visa
exactly.
So they can turn up?
Exactly.
And for that...
That's where the government knows.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the most doable things in a Patriot Act for cyberspace, and I don't mean that in a unduly pejorative way. I just mean if you're trying to put together a bill of stuff you can do right now, if you think the threat is coming from there... then, yeah, why would we possibly want to train, you know, it's like the terrorists on 9/11 we're on our own flight simulators. Like, how can we, you know, have suborned that? I think it probably raises the larger question, I hope not so large that it loses the nuance, of just, we're both vulnerable because of an open environment, an open and trusting one, and of course, one would hope it's also one of our most powerful weapons.
It's a two-edged sword. Like,
yeah, if it's hearts and minds, to actually say an open network where ideas can flow freely is far more a threat to an authoritarian government than it is to a democratic one.
Witness the fall of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
But there is such an intellectual interchange between China and the United States today. I should be astonished if any forward-looking government would say, "Oh, you're from Beijing Dashui. We won't let you in."
This also just gets back to the first half of Cliff's answer, which is the rise of automated translation tools. I think will be extremely helpful and have an impact. That you have populations that really don't talk much to each other. In some spaces, we call bridge bloggers the people who happen to run interference between the two groups. But when the day comes that you can do chat roulette and have it be automatically translated like that, or any of the equivalents, instant messaging, Facebook friending, that may well remove some inhibitory barriers that both expose you to more surveillance, but also let ideas about openness flow more easily. Yeah. We are, let's take one last quick question and then call it an evening. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Tim, and I'm a grad student at the Kennedy School. My question relates to what kind of actors are currently the most important ones in that arena when it comes down to developing proposals and mechanisms to deal with the challenges you outlined earlier. Is it because we've heard now that in the U.S. it's not so much the government, whereas in China it is. What are the main players in the U.S. and on the global level where we would need to look for in the next years to come? What kind of governance mechanisms will be designed for that? And how much are those coordinated?
Thanks for your short question, which of course requires a very brief answer.
Who are the important actors? I'm embarrassed. I get what I find to be most informative to me are very specialized blogs that I follow, Slashdot being the start of it all. That has nothing to do with your answer, though. Who are the main actors in the United States pushing for legislation? Inevitably, it's people who are clumsy and worry more about protecting their copyrights in music than they care about what's... it's very, very muddled and muddy, and the intelligence community seems to want a wide variety of, if not backdoors, at least abilities to monitor and watch. But they are not really the actors who are pushing for international agreements and so on. I don't know if there are many.
Well, I think it's a great question. I think it's one for which at this stage, it's almost like a Mira Rivera said, you see what you want to see in it, and you see what you have cultivated as your own tools and ideas. So if you're coming from a government perspective wanting to protect your populace like you do against military attack or civil unrest, you look to those tools. You're like, where can I station a guard? I don't mean that pejoratively. It's like, tell me where to send the troops, or what treaty do I need to ink with what country to do something here? What MLATs are needed? If you're with a private security firm, you're like, buy our product. If everybody had Symantec, we wouldn't be having these problems. And that's piecemeal, but they offer some solutions, and the market will drive solutions in the absence of government intervention. If you come from an ethos where cooperation is the norm and the bad apple is the rarity, you look for ways to leverage that cooperation so that you can expel the bad apples without having to completely change the substrate that all of this grew out of. As you might guess, that's where I think Cliff's sensibilities may lie. It's certainly where my sensibilities lie, with the kind of tentativeness that I realize, first, that we have a grave problem. I don't think it's business as usual. And second, It's not clear that the kinds of solutions I'm talking about, like this barely sketched out mutual aid system, will work. But I would rather try it before I move to the last line antibiotic that I should be saving for the truly rainy day. I'd rather have some systemic stuff. And it really is, it does analogize nicely to, you know, we're all eating a terrible diet right now. If we were to actually make a few changes in that, a few fewer potato chips, the sea change would be much different than just racing in with angioplasty everywhere. Mm-hmm. This is an extremely specific extended metaphor. No doubt autobiographical at some level. But
potato chips?
Yeah, exactly. But I am eager to explore ways to have netizens at large, small and medium webmasters, small and medium internet users, realize what's so special about this network and offer them ways to be participating here and there to secure it. The way that if you could persuade people surrounding a park to every so often, you put a few bins out, they can clean up the litter themselves rather than saying we need a 24-hour guard to arrest people who litter, or we need to hire, you know, a cleaning crew to come through once a week and make it their problem. To actually make it our problem, rather than just being afraid of it or have this kind of resignation, this learned helplessness of, I guess I'm being surveilled at all times, that's the internet for you. But rather to see that we can make a difference, that's my hope at least for a path forward. Please join me in thanking Cliff Stoll for taking the time out.
Delighted. Many thanks.
Absolute pleasure.